You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
What are you doing right now? Perhaps you're in the supermarket. Maybe you're on a run or on the commute. But wherever you are in the world, and whatever you're doing, right now you're also listening to my voice. This is the power of podcasts. The ability to communicate with your audience in an intimate and intentional way through audio. I'm Bea Duncan, Senior Partnerships Producer at Intelligence Squared. We've been a world-leading forum for talks, debates, and events for over two decades. And we also use our cutting-edge curation, creativity, and editorial expertise to elevate your brand to new audiences with podcasting. Intrigued? To find out what we can do for your organization, book into a free consultation with me today. Find out more by going to www.intelligencesquared.com/partnerships.
Welcome to Intelligence Squared, where great minds meet. I'm Head of Programming, Connor Boyle. Coming up on the podcast, Annie Jacobson, the investigative journalist and author whose books tell factual stories about Warcraft and the government secrecy that surrounds it, but they simultaneously read like unputdownable thrillers. It's not surprising, then, that her Pulitzer-nominated work can be found in both journalistic pieces and fiction, including Tom Clancy's Jack Ryan TV show. Previous books have covered topics ranging from the CIA to Area 51 and the Second World War. Her latest book is Nuclear War, a Scenario. And recently, she joined Josh Glancy, editor of The News Review at the Sunday Times, to talk about it.
Our guest today is Annie Jacobson. I think, Annie, I first came across your work... You wrote a book about Area 51, didn't you?
Yes, I did.
About 13 or 14 years ago. And it's fair to say you tend to be very interested in and work on what one might say the sort of the margins of American defense life, be it Area 51. You've looked at DARPA and sort of some of the kind of PSYOP stuff they do. And now you've written a book about nuclear war called, very simply, Nuclear War, a Scenario. I wouldn't recommend reading it just before bed. It's quite a tough, alarming read. And in it, you basically outline what a potential nuclear war might look like. You pull no punches. This is obviously an imaginary scenario, but it's based on very deep reporting, clearly. And you make that clear in the book. You've spoken to all sorts of people who have been responsible for this scenario, this kind of doomsday planning, over many years. And the result is a sort of terrifying but somehow plausible scenario of what an unfolding nuclear attack might look like. And in the book, it's a strike on America, on Washington, D.C., from North Korea. So it's a fascinating, it's a very gripping read. You've written in it in quite a kind of, almost like a thriller, although it's obviously all rooted in reporting and facts, conceptual facts at least. But tell me, presumably you've been working on this for several years. We are currently in a sort of state of world affairs where I don't think we're in great fear of nuclear war, particularly today, but there is certainly the atmosphere around and the debate around nuclear war has changed since Russia's invasion of Ukraine. We now have a nuclear power involved in a major war that is not always winning. So when did you decide to write this book? And I think more critically, why?
So as an investigative journalist who writes about war, weapons, national security, and secrets, I'd previously written six books on military and intelligence programs, the CIA, the Pentagon, DARPA, Area 51. All of these programs designed to prevent nuclear World War III. I can't tell you how many of my sources have shared exactly that with me, sort of with a sense of pride saying, you know, we prevented nuclear World War III. And during the previous administration's sort of rhetoric, the President Trump's rhetoric around fire and fury and the North Korean, this idea of nuclear button that came up with North Korea, I began to really think about my long history of reporting on nuclear weapons as a preventative means. And I began to ask the question of myself, what would happen if deterrence failed? And then I took that exact question to the highest level national security people that I could locate to speak on the subject. And what I found shocked me. And that is the result of all that reporting is nuclear war a scenario.
And Annie, before we get into the scenario that you outline and the reporting you did, you're obviously someone who's attracted to the kind of the deep or the hidden side of defense and of military capabilities and the what ifs. And what do you think it is that has drawn you to this story and to these kinds of very dark and little known issues that sort of live almost in the substrate of our society?
You know, I myself am very curious and I'm always asking questions. You know, when someone says, okay, this is a dumb question, I almost always butt in and say, there is no such thing as a dumb question. Mm. I suppose that my trajectory as a national security reporter has been, well, it's been my own. I don't know if it's been unique, but I know for certain that I'm often up against what I perceive to be sort of a status quo in reporting. You know, ask this question, not this question. Don't touch upon that issue. Don't mention that issue. And that's just simply not interesting to me. I want to know what is unknowable. I'll give you an example. I wrote a book called Surprise, Kill, Vanish on the CIA's paramilitary. And I reported on Title 50, which is what gives the CIA the authority to basically do whatever they want in a certain lane of national security on direct orders from the president. And initially when I began reporting that, oh, Annie, don't report on Title 50. Well, I did. And now if I notice, often in regular mainstream sort of more legacy press, you will see people mentioning Title 50. And I say to myself, goal achieved. You know, bring the facts to the public and then let people begin to unearth what I see as the more important, you know, you called them the margins. I just called them that which is hidden, because I always think that which is hidden is far more interesting than just regurgitating an opinion about a set of facts that most people are already well familiar with. And I certainly do that in nuclear war. A lot of people have asked me, how could you bring this reporting? It must be classified. And, you know, when you look at my list of sources, which I on purpose put in the front of the book, multiple secretaries of defense, Obama's FEMA director, that would be the organization in charge of taking care of the people after a nuclear war, a former director of strategic command, that's who's in charge of the nukes, a former nuclear submarine force commander. You see that I went straight to those in the know and asked them to take me up to the razor's edge of what can be known so that I can present it to the public, so that the public can understand just how crazy nuclear war would be. Did I ever think when I began reporting this book in the early days of the pandemic that we would be in a situation now where nuclear armed nations are threatening nuclear use? No, but it makes me very grateful that I reported this book when I did.
Yeah, because in a way, I mean, there's lots of ways to read this book, but one way to read it is as clearly as a warning that you actually, it's one thing to know that nuclear war would be awful. It's another thing to actually read some of your descriptions in that book. And, you know, in many ways, the starting point for this is Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So, you know, that's the one occasion in history where weapons of these kinds of level of destruction have been deployed. Did you go to visit Hiroshima and Nagasaki? Did you kind of immerse yourself in that as a starting point in the descriptions of what happened then? And how did that sort of act in terms of as a kind of foundation for your for your work here.
You know, one of the most shocking parts about the effects of atomic weapons at Hiroshima and Nagasaki that I think you're referring to, and you can really nerd out on this if you go to the footnotes of my book, the effects on people and on things were compiled by members of the U.S. military in the immediate aftermath of those atomic weapons. The third degree burns on people, the total destruction of buildings by secondary fires, radiation poisoning, which at the time was completely unknown and was just called Disease X. But again, I just lightly touch upon Hiroshima and Nagasaki from a historical perspective in what's essentially the section of the book that says how we got here. And that is the sort of prelude leading up to where we are when this hypothetical scenario would begin. But to your point about Hiroshima and Nagasaki, how horrifically gruesome that I know and was able to relay these details about what nuclear weapons do to people and to things in grotesque and appalling detail that I'm glad horrified you. I know them because they are sourced from Defense Department documents, thick tomes that are now called things like The Effects of Nuclear Weapons and other very sterilized titles. I footnote them in the book. But that began as Army Manual Number 50 when scientists began compiling these effects back in 1945 in the aftermath of the first and only atomic bombs that have been used in war thus far.
Yeah, it's one of the many scary things in this book is you describe the difference between the kinds of weapons that were the bombs that were dropped back in 1945 and the kind of bombs that you're talking about that exist today and could be exist today. I wonder if you could just describe to us the difference in scale that we're talking about there.
So for readers who aren't familiar with the difference between an atomic bomb and a thermonuclear bomb, which, by the way, is just about everyone on the planet besides, you know, national security wonks, and is an important part of this book, bringing this information in layman's terms to the people. So an atomic bomb, 15 kilotons at Hiroshima, for example, when you think about a thermonuclear weapon, the power and scale is almost unimaginable. Here's the best way I can describe it. A thermonuclear bomb has an atomic bomb inside the weapon, which is used as a fuse. And that description comes to me directly from Richard Garwin, now 93, who is the man who drew the plans for the first thermonuclear bomb. People think, oh, Edward Teller is the father of the thermonuclear bomb. Yes, in theory. But Teller couldn't figure out a way to make his theory actually explode with the kind of power that the Defense Department was looking for. It was a young Richard Garwin. He was in his early 20s at the time when he drew those plans that actually worked. And Garwin described to me that power, and I relay it in the book, and it just sort of makes your head spin. I mean, the center point is 180 million degrees. That's five times hotter than the center of the sun.
And so I wondered if you might take us through a very short version of the strike that you describe in the book. I used to live in Washington, D.C., which is where the strike, you imagine, lands. So it was particularly harrowing for me because I was one of the people who would have been radiated in this imaginary scenario. But talk us through what happens very briefly in the book and how the scenario might unfold. I wonder if you could give us a quick précis.
So the very short condensed scenario, and there's quite a lot of technology involved, goes like this. It's a spring afternoon, and a ICBM launch is detected coming out of North Korea. And the way it's detected is by a very intense technological system in space called SBIRS, stands for Space-Based Infrared Satellite System. The Defense Department sees the launch within a fraction of a second. And you begin to understand just how fast all this unfolds when you realize in a split second that the Defense Department has spent $1 trillion having a kind of Paul Revere in space. And so you have launch, and then within a matter of seconds, that information, that data is sent down from space to different facilities in the United States, all part of this nuclear command and control system. One of them is called the Aerospace Data Facility in Colorado. Its very existence was classified until 2008. You have the Space Force involved. You have NORAD. You have an immediate alert in three nuclear command bunkers across America. Cheyenne Mountain is, of course, famous for movies. That's in Colorado. The Pentagon, there's a bunker beneath the Pentagon called the National Military Command Center. And there's a bunker in the middle of the United States at STRATCOM. That's Strategic Command, the organization in charge of the nuclear weapons. And that's in a bunker beneath Offutt Air Force Base in Nebraska. And suddenly the system goes into effect. Why? All of these organizations must now prepare for two things. One, they need secondary confirmation, which will happen from ground radar systems in a matter of minutes. And two, they have to prepare to brief the president. And this is where things really get heated, because you quickly learn that it's just a matter of minutes, maybe five, maybe six, when the president of the United States is informed that a nuclear missile is on the way. Why? Because America has a policy called launch on warning. It's exactly like it sounds. We do not wait to absorb a nuclear blow to launch a counterattack if someone dares launch nuclear weapons at us. That's the whole theory of deterrence. We do not wait. We launch before the nuclear weapon hits the United States. That's policy. And that policy, while it may seem, you know, very muscular and an inherent part of deterrence, this idea, don't you dare hit us, I wanted to show what happens when deterrence fails. And then we really get going here in the scenario once the president is briefed and once that secondary confirmation comes in.
This may sound like a stupid question, but...
There's no such thing as a stupid question.
There's no such thing, so I'll ask it. How would they know that an incoming missile was a nuclear weapon as opposed to just a missile? I.e., how you could know, they be certain that they... What they were dealing with?
I have the president ask that exact question. Okay. So when you get to nerd out for a few brief seconds here and I explain to you, as it was explained to me about missiles, we begin to very quickly realize, a ballistic missile is a missile that takes approximately 30 minutes to get from one side of the world to the other. It's a giant rocket with a nuclear weapon in its nose cone. That is what ballistic missiles are designed for. And they occur in three phases of flight. Again, this stuff has just been mapped out by the Pentagon ad infinitum, although most people don't know it. The first 5 minutes are what's called boost phase. That's when you can see the hot rocket exhaust coming out the back of the rocket. The next 20 minutes are what is called mid-course phase, and that's when the missile, rather the warhead, is just flying through space about 500 miles above the Earth. And it continues on its trajectory all the way until the remaining 100 seconds, where the warhead enters terminal phase and then detonates on its target. So it's literally 24, 25, 30, 33 minutes from launch to target. So you can imagine now how that kind of a missile is tracked in space, which is what would indicate that it is a ballistic missile en route to the United States. Very specifically, it's being tracked. But to your question, how do we know it's a nuclear weapon in the nose cone? There is no answer. And that's why I have the president ask that in this scenario. And the answer is, who on earth would be foolish enough to send a ballistic missile at the United States if it didn't have a nuclear weapon? And that is an actual fact.
The events calendar is filling up here at Intelligence Squared, and to create each one, we obviously rely on some brilliant guests and onstage talent. But behind the scenes, there's also a producer, a production team, and the budget in the mix too. You've got to keep an eye on all of that stuff in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. And you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because it's super easy to get started. NetSuite exists in the cloud, you see, no hardware needed. So you're cutting IT costs too. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
Yeah, it would be a slightly risky prank, wouldn't it? You know, reading your book, at times you always have to sort of pinch yourself to think that we've created these weapons, and it can shock you sometimes, even though it's something we've all grown up with. But one thing that also took me aback was, I think on some level, we all like to think that there's a defense system in place. You know, there have been various defense systems over the years. There was Star Wars under Reagan and various others. You know, and we do see rocket defense systems, say in Israel, they use the Iron Dome defense system to shoot down rockets. So perhaps in the back of my mind, I like to think that somewhere deep in a bunker, somewhere in, you know, the middle of America, there are things that can shoot down missiles. In theory, that's true. But as you outline in your book, we're very, very bad at it, aren't we? And so the likelihood is that America wouldn't be able to shoot down incoming missiles. Is that right?
You know, you're not alone in that sort of preconception. I was at a dinner party in the early days of reporting this book, where I mentioned what I was working on, and someone who was more knowledgeable than, you know, not, said to me to the effect of, "Oh, Annie, don't be silly. We have an interceptor missile system for that. We would shoot that down, just like the Iron Dome." And of course, as I learned in my reporting, that's complete fantasy. Inasmuch that we have a total of 44 interceptor missiles. And when you consider that the United States has 1,707 weapons, nuclear weapons that are ready for launch, and Russia has approximately the same number, essentially ready for launch, with a couple thousand more in reserve, you realize that 44 missiles against more than 1,000 of them is not a great ratio. Even one nuclear missile coming in is going to run into problems, or rather the interceptor system is going to run into problems trying to take out one nuclear missile, as I describe in my book, because its success rate hovers around 50%. And, you know, in a very short amount of time, I take the reader through actually what happens. The interceptor missile is essentially kind of like a mini ICBM. It's a rocket, and it fires up off its launch pad either in Santa Barbara here in California or in Alaska up at Fort Greely. And it's going into space to try to now shoot down this incoming warhead. One of them's going something like Mach 20, the other one's going Mach 14. Inside the interceptor missile is something called an exo-atmospheric kill vehicle. It's a tiny mechanism that is going to essentially try to strike the incoming nuclear warhead in space at these incredible speeds. Someone in the U.S. Defense Department described it as trying to hit a bullet with a bullet. And that's why the success rate is so low. Another general explained to me that our interceptor missiles have to fire, you know, fast after one another. They don't have what's called look, wait, look technology, or look, see, look technology. And so who's ever at the helm has to make a decision very quickly how many of these 44 nuclear missiles they're going to waste on one incoming warhead to try and stop it. In my scenario, I have four interceptors try and take it out. They all fail. And that, by the way, was not red flagged for inaccuracy by a general who read the book for me, kind of fact checking. And so you get the sense of just how precarious this idea is that our interceptors would be able to stop an incoming nuclear weapon.
Is one of the messages of your book that we should be more scared, or at least more aware of just how much, just the level of apocalyptic damage that is only a few presses of a button away? And I guess a part two to that question, did you finish this book more or less worried about that yourself?
You know, maybe that's the most important question to ask, right? Is what do we take away from this book? I know for me, it goes like this. You know, when I was in high school in 1983, there was a television program, a fictional story of, it was called The Day After. It was a miniseries. And it showed what war, nuclear war between the United States and Russia, Soviet Russia, would look like. And it was so controversial. It was so terrifying. ABC News producers, or ABC television producers, rather, were encouraged not to air it. After it aired, and some 100 million Americans watched it, one of those Americans was President Ronald Reagan. And he wrote in his memoirs that he became depressed after he saw it. But then he took action. He called up Gorbachev. And ultimately, just a few years later, they had a nuclear reduction treaty. That treaty is what is responsible for reducing what was at one point in the 1980s, 70,000 nuclear weapons. 70,000. That number has now been reduced down to 12,500. And so, when I consider that, I see that when people get frightened enough, when people like the president get depressed enough by the idea that the world could end in nuclear apocalypse, even in error, I actually feel hopeful and am someone who, as a reporter and also fundamentally as an optimist, believes the more attention you can put on the madness that is the potential of nuclear war, the more progress can be made toward communicating our way out of this rabbit hole.
And there's lots of novel and fancy words in this world. Exo-atmospheric is a new one I've just learned. But that one word you just used, MAD, is the acronym that sits at the absolute heart of all this, isn't it? Mutually assured destruction, the idea that we won't destroy you because we don't want you to destroy us. And that equilibrium has thus far kept us all alive in the 80 years since these bombs were first used. And you mentioned Reagan, and him and Gorbachev both told the world, they said, a nuclear war cannot be won and must never be fought. It's probably the most famous ever quote, one of, about nuclear weapons. Our MAD still holds, thankfully. Do you still believe in mutually assured destruction? Do you think it still is an equilibrium to live by for the world? Or do you think we should be continuing to try and disarm and move towards a post-nuclear future? I'm not sure how realistic that is, given how much geopolitical antagonism there is in the world. But what do you think?
You know, there are so many experts who have been working on this issue, whether it be nuclear non-proliferation, diplomacy, you know, communication. The systems are set up in place to have those dialogues begin. The point of my book, me as a national security reporter, as a storyteller, as a narrative storyteller, is very much to bring this idea to readers, to listeners. You just said the best quote of all, you know, a nuclear war cannot be won and must never be fought. And so when I think about this idea of deterrence, because you asked whether or not I believe in it, as I write in the book, that is a theoretical phenomenon, meaning it is just an idea. And yes, for decades it has held. But if you nerd out on small groups within the National Security Command and Control talking to one another in public forums, as I do, you can kind of get a sense of how actually a deep fear that deterrence could fail exists. And I found that in the words of Deputy Commander of STRATCOM, General Thomas Bussier. I quote him in the book, and you can see him on YouTube giving this talk to people within STRATCOM, and he says, if deterrence fails, it all unravels. And that unraveling is what I describe in Nuclear War, a Scenario. And that unraveling is what I believe is valuable for people to think about, people to talk about. Because as one of my sources said to me when I said, why doesn't the Congress do more about this issue? He said to me, oh, Annie, don't be so naive. The U.S. Congress only pays attention to what people are talking about.
So, yeah, we are really held together, as you say, by an idea, and we're kept alive by this concept of deterrence. It would, I suppose, take what we would think of as a mad person or someone who was somehow outside of the boundaries of accepted political behavior to launch a strike, or certainly an unprovoked one. I'm guessing in the book, your protagonist is North Korea. I'm guessing part of the reason you chose North Korea was perhaps they most closely represent that force in the world today, but you tell me. But you know, when you look at Vladimir Putin and Russia, and you look at the potential for the US and China to, you know, come to blows over Taiwan or other territories, do you think we're in a world where there is a higher nuclear threat at the moment, and where do you see that threat coming from?
I think it's interesting what you said about normative behavior among nuclear-armed nations, because you could argue that Russia and the United States have been, you know, playing this game for a long time, for decades, and even China. The reason why I chose North Korea to be the rogue actor in this scenario is because that is precisely how North Korea behaves and why it is so dangerous. I'll give you an example that surprised me when I learned it. All ballistic missile tests are announced. Okay, so many people know that part of the equation here. For example, when the war in Ukraine began, the United States publicly announced that it was not going to test one of its ICBMs as had been planned for over a year. Russia has done the same, you know. It's a way of saying we're not going to, you know, pull the lens over to this dangerous area right now. Something could go wrong in terms of interpretation. I was surprised to learn that North Korea does not announce its missile tests, not its ballistic missile tests at all. And this is incredibly dangerous. They have launched over 100 missiles since January of 2022. Imagine the tension in the U.S. Nuclear Command and Control System, at the Aerospace Data Center in Colorado that we spoke of earlier, in the individuals who are watching those, that cyber system, who are watching those launches. Imagine the tension, the room for error that must go on every time North Korea launches a ballistic missile. And, you know, I do hope that after people read this book, they read the news about North Korea behaving this way differently, and they realize how potentially disastrous this kind of rogue behavior is.
You know, one thing that really struck me reading the book was that ultimately there are all these incredibly complex systems in place that have been very carefully planned out by the best defense minds in the world. But when it really comes down to it, there's a lot of room for error. And there is really, it is going to come down to a few people with a very short space of time under enormous pressure, fear, adrenaline, shock. You know, human emotions will be at play. I mean, you mentioned at one point that basically once the president's been briefed, he has about 6 minutes, or she could be by then. About 6 minutes to make a decision. And also that there is effectively no chain of command. It is just the president at that point. And your president, your imaginary president, talks to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs and says, well, what do you think I should do? And the chairman says, well, that's not in my call. That, I think, is what's scary about this, is that the moment that this system is breached, it does come down to a few people acting in a very short space of time, doesn't it?
It does. And to pin those details down and get a sense of how things really might go down, I interviewed two former secretaries of defense, asking them those exact questions. And it was William Perry who shared with me this other element of the scenario, which then, of course, opened up a bunch of doors in my thinking and reporting, which went like this. When Perry realized that, he said, if I put myself in those shoes and I would be trying to advise the president how to act, I would also be thinking about whether or not it would make sense for me to leave the Pentagon immediately to try and save myself, his exact words. Because while all of this is going on, this idea of the president making the decision to launch a nuclear counterattack, you have a separate lane that's concerned with the continuity of government. And that's this idea that the government has to keep functioning even after a nuclear war. And so to report those how that scenario runs parallel to the nuclear scenario, I was able to interview, for example, Obama's former FEMA director, who described to me how he would be taken off to a bunker and what goes into effect behind all that. And that's where you realize there are so many wheels spinning, so many incredibly important decisions that need to be made in seconds and minutes. The room for error magnifies as these different decision trees unfold.
Well, Annie, it's an important book, because, as you say, you can't read it and stay complacent about these things. But I do think, in a funny way, there is cause for optimism in the fact that you wrote it and the fact that we are here talking about this. And you know, as you kind of alluded to earlier, it's by taking it seriously that you hopefully maintain our caution about this issue. But do you still feel optimistic about avoiding the kind of scenario that unfolds in your book?
I often think about what Craig Fugate, who was the FEMA director during the Obama administration, told me about trying to plan for nuclear war. You know, he said to me, Annie, as an agency, we plan for asteroids. These are what are called low probability, high consequence events. And that's what we've been talking about. Allegedly low probability, but most definitely high consequence. But what Fugate told me was that after a nuclear war, there would be very little FEMA could do because everyone would be dead. And he said, you know, what comes down to then is hope that you stocked Pedialyte, and try and self-survive. And with that kind of a doomsday prediction from an actual government, highly placed government official, I do agree that it opens up the door for all of us to realize this is total madness and a solution needs to be found.
I'm intrigued to know what there's a Pedialyte in this country, we call it Dioralyte, but I'm intrigued to know what role that would play in a post-apocalyptic world. But maybe we'll
discuss Well, what it actually is, because immediately I went to Target and like was reading the contents of Pedialyte,
right.
It is, you know, it replaces your electrolytes.
Right.
And yeah,
I think
on a hangover, but
you know, it was a great detail that he gave me because I can't stop thinking about that, because you just do really realize that things, sometimes an object visualized in your brain says a lot more to the human heart than some kind of theoretical conception, be it deterrence or the nuclear triad. What it really boils down to is a bunch of human beings trying not to wind up in an absolutely apocalyptic type scenario. And I think with the full force of humanity behind such ideas as ending the madness, anything is possible. We saw that from two former presidents, and I welcome some kind of a change.
All right, well, I'll be going to stock up on rehydration salts. But Annie, thank you for that. It's a sobering but fascinating conversation. And I really would recommend the book. You'll rip through it because it is very gripping. Nuclear War, a Scenario, and it's available in bookshops now. I'm Josh Glancy from the Sunday Times, and you've been listening to an Intelligence Squared podcast. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Intelligence Squared. This episode was produced by Connor Boyle and edited by Tom Hall. If you want to keep up with everything going on at Intelligence Squared, sign up to the newsletter. Head over to intelligencesquared.com to get the heads up on all our live events coming up. And members can also peruse over 20 years of our back catalogue featuring some of the world's great minds. That's all over at intelligencesquared.com.
What are you doing right now? Perhaps you're in the supermarket. Maybe you're on a run or on the commute. But wherever you are in the world, and whatever you're doing, right now you're also listening to my voice. This is the power of podcasts. The ability to communicate with your audience in an intimate and intentional way through audio. I'm Bea Duncan, Senior Partnerships Producer at Intelligence Squared. We've been a world-leading forum for talks, debates, and events for over two decades. And we also use our cutting-edge curation, creativity, and editorial expertise to elevate your brand to new audiences with podcasting. Intrigued? To find out what we can do for your organization, book into a free consultation with me today. Find out more by going to www.intelligencesquared.com/partnerships.